Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're at the midpoint of April, which is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so we're going to highlight a couple of agencies providing support to victims, beginning with the Susan B. Anthony Project, celebrating 40 years of service in Torrington and communities in central Litchfield County. Then we're going to head to Meriden to chat with folks from Women and Family Center, which provides sexual assault support services as well as a number of other critical programs focusing on youth homelessness and workforce development. Their first ever Walk for Hope to End Homelessness is coming up, so we'll clue you in on that as well. And finally, we're taking the long road up to Ashford, Connecticut, to let all of the state know that Paul Newman's hole-in-the-wall gang camp is back following a devastating fire, and they're ready to reopen for kids and volunteers better than ever. You want to learn more or maybe get involved? Listen in. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. From native perennials like Blue Aster, Showy, Goldenrod, and Red Bee Balm, to North American shrubs and trees like Virginia, Sweet Spire, Black Cherry, and Fragrant Sumac, the Aspetuck Land Trust is going to offer over 60 plants at their biannual plant sale this spring. These plants not only add color and beauty to the garden, but attract beneficial insects, birds, and other wildlife that help restore our ecosystem. Ordering for this year's very popular program begins April 18th, and you can get all the details you need and learn more about this organization by visiting aspetucklandtrust.org. Well, it's been a few years since we caught up with Gene Fusco at the Susan B. Anthony Project, which provides crisis and support services for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault with confidential, free, available 24/7 service. SBAproject.org is their website. Big news in 2023 for Jean and her team. The Susan B. Anthony Project is celebrating 40 years serving many of the communities north of the Waterbury area up into western Connecticut and Litchfield County. They are also one of just a handful of agencies in the state of Connecticut who are both part of the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, who we talk with and who serves as our resource here for the people often, but they are also part of the Connecticut Alliance to End Sexual Violence. So we're going to talk a lot about how things have changed over the nearly three decades that Jean has been heading up or part of this organization, as well as inviting you gentlemen to step up, perhaps a little bit painfully if you're brave, in May as they commence with their sixth annual Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event. We'll tell you all about that and how to get involved. But for now, Jean Fusco, welcome to the program. Happy anniversary.
Thank you very much.
So I think the last time you and I chatted was kind of in the early stages of the COVID era. So in the short term, how have things been going for your clients and constituents and communities as we've sort of come out of the thick of COVID danger?
You know, it has been an interesting time, and I think that whenever there is something pivotal that's happening in the world around us, it has impact not only on that time, but in the time beyond. And so we saw an increase by as much as 20% for requests for services during that early part and throughout COVID. And we continue to see that number of our victims and survivors reaching in for services, you know, at that level. And predominantly in requests for shelter and requests for court services, both criminal and civil court services. And so I would say that that has been an impact that continues for us.
And how are you guys doing in terms of maintaining or increasing staffing or the allocation of staff to deal with this sustained period of need on the part of the communities you serve?
Staffing has been a challenge since COVID in that there have been so many people who have looked at the workforce in differing ways and what their own individual and family needs may be. And having said that, we have been successful most recently in, being able to staff up to the levels that we need to serve those who are requesting services from us. And I would also say that a part of our organization's focus is we receive about 50% of funding through pass-through funding of those two coalitions from the federal and state government. And beyond that, each year, we sustain ourselves through our own fundraising efforts for the additional 50%. So from that standpoint, we did not have to ask people to leave the workplace like a lot of other organizations of differing sorts had to do during that time. So we are strong in the folks that we have on board in the way that we're able to continue those services by those efforts that we've made as an organization.
And if memory serves me, your team is quite tenured. You have some long haulers with the Susan B. Anthony Project in terms of your and I'm not talking about COVID.
Yes, that is true. We have a number of staff members who have been here 12 plus years and some, in, 20 and beyond. So that is also very helpful. Institutional knowledge is, derived and passed along to those who are newer coming on board. And that's helpful in providing services to victims and survivors.
Very good. Well, also, if memory serves me, it was Litchfield County or the Torrington area back several decades ago when a particular domestic violence case spurred the beginnings of what were going to be sea changes in the way law enforcement and first responders end up dealing with, meeting, and interacting and supporting domestic and sexual violence victims. But I have to say that tapping into law enforcement services and the judicial system over the past few years, it seems like not a year goes by that particularly law enforcement agencies are not continuing to raise the bar in terms of the way they are interacting with agencies like yours and the individuals who come to you for help.
That is true. And one of the things that we really are focused upon and pride ourselves upon is the collaborative relationships that we can garner within the communities that we serve. And across the state of Connecticut, there is a lethality assessment program that partners police departments and organizations like ours together so that when there is a first response on site to what appears to be a domestic violence response, there is a lethality assessment that is done. There are questions asked, and right from that site, the police can connect to the 24/7 emergency hotlines that exist across the state, speak to a counselor advocate, offer that same service to the primary victim on that site. And in that way, we continue to strengthen collaborations with police and organization response together.
And in some cases, physically deliver those individuals to you.
That is true. There are times where in a circumstance like that, if emergency shelter is needed, the police will assist with getting someone to services to have a safe space for that night and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Good. So switching back to this sort of dual role that the Susan B. Anthony Project plays, I think you mentioned before we went on the air, you're just one of five agencies that have the dual membership or the dual affiliation with the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence and the Connecticut Alliance to End Sexual Violence. In terms of the communities you serve and the clients who you are and have been serving, is there quite a lot of overlap? Are you finding that quite a lot of domestic violence victims also present to you with either current, past, or possibly even long past sexual violence histories?
Yes, I think that it is always true that sexual violence, which is one of the forms of domestic violence, can exist in intimate partner relationships. And having said that, there are a group of victim survivors who do not necessarily have domestic violence in their background, but they have experienced sexual abuse and or sexual violence. And that includes children, women, and men in all circumstances of sexual violence and or domestic violence.
On the side of the judicial system, there have also been accommodations and improvements that have been consistently being made. Certainly, the judicial system had its own kind of set of nightmare scenarios through the COVID era, which are hopefully improving. But to their credit, when it comes to victims of sexual or domestic violence throughout Connecticut, and I know in your jurisdiction, there are a number of professionals within the judicial arena who are who specialize and really step up in partnership with the Susan B. Anthony Project as well.
Yes, we have, and especially in the family services area of the court system, that is an area where a lot of survivors have need, both from a civil and a criminal perspective. And so we do partner with our own family violence victim advocates, both civil and criminal, court-focused with that particular department. A number of things happened during COVID to make sure that the issues of domestic and sexual violence remained critical in terms of court response. And so some processes became possible to do online. And then in all instances where it was needed to have, you know, next day arraignments and that kind of thing through the court process, those things were maintained. There was a period of time where some of the services were combined by jurisdiction to be able to facilitate that. But we are pretty much back to, full operating services by individual service areas in the courts now.
One of the other really great things that I found in talking with leaders of agencies like the Susan B. Anthony Project and Eugene is that they have been working really hard and have been very, very successful in creating, sustaining, and growing programs that are not just sending messages and tactics for prevention and how to effectively and safely respond to women in their communities, but men as well. And I know that's the case with your agency, but it also takes attracting those men to the cause so they could learn about the successful role they can play in their communities to be able to support organizations like the Susan B. Anthony Project. One of the great ways that I've discovered when I look across a more local organization that I work with that hosts a Walk a Mile in Her Shoes event is, when you've got 400, 600, 800 burly men walking around in women's shoes to send the message that they not only feel for these victims, but would go to at least a mile's length to support them. You're having a Walk a Mile in Her Shoes in May. So let's tell folks how wherever they're listening in Connecticut, they really need to come up to Litchfield County and get involved.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. And in addition to my points that I make about collaboration, obviously having allies in this work is critical. And so Walk a Mile in Her Shoes is a fun way for us to raise awareness and to talk about the really important and critical service provision that we do around sexual and domestic violence in Northwest Connecticut. And as you say, during the walk, men and boys and others, anyone who's interested as an ally in walking may, but they literally walk a mile in women's high-heeled shoes designed for men. And they are creating awareness. And during that process, they also bring in donations to the organization, which supports ongoing services. This year, our event, which is our sixth annual Walk a Mile in Our Shoes, is going to be on Sunday, May 21st in the center of Litchfield. And it is really our largest fundraising event at Susan B. Anthony Project. And we have an event, a post-event that's quite fun, that takes place at the Tapping Reef Meadow, which is part of the historical society there. Mm-hmm. And there's an after party where everybody who participates in the walk, as either walkers or even those who have been supporters on the sidelines cheering the walkers on, are able to come and socialize for a bit.
Very good. Our time is short, Jean, but we want to spend the last 30 seconds or so just speaking directly to anyone who may feel they are victims, or any loved ones or people, coworkers, friends, neighbors of those who might be victims, to just remind them of how they can access help beyond calling 911, because they can do it by text, they can do it by phone, they can even do it by internet now, right?
Yes, there are opportunities to do all of that in all of the ways that you say. I think the most important thing to say is we all know someone. If it's not ourselves, it's someone perhaps in our lives. And it's really important to create awareness that there are services. They are inclusive services. They are available 24/7, 365, and they're free of charge to those who need them.
Very good. SBAproject.org is the website for the Susan B. Anthony Project, serving Northwestern Connecticut now 40 years strong. Their executive, Jean Fusco, pleased to chat with you again, Jean. Gentlemen, wherever you are, participate in the 6th Annual Walk a Mile in Her Shoes to support the Susan B. Anthony Project coming up in May. And if anyone wants to support this organization, learn how to volunteer for it or go to it for resources, sbaproject.org is their website. Jean, thank you so much. Well, it's been a while since we heard from my fellow Lithuanian, Wayne Valaitis, and so thrilled to have him back representing a very worthy agency servicing the greater Meriden area and communities around that Central Connecticut municipality. And, you know, along with old friends come new things. The first is a new friend. We're going to meet Carissa Conway, who works with the Women and Families Center, particularly with Project Reach, which is a really important initiative related to youth homelessness and other issues around homelessness that we talk about a lot here, but can't really talk about it enough because the problem isn't really going away. And we're also happy to celebrate a brand new event coming to the Greater Meriden area. That is the Women and Families Center inaugural Walk for Hope to End Homelessness. It's coming up on May 7th, so we're going to hear all about that and a number of other programs at the agency. So Carissa and Wayne, welcome to the program. And Wayne, let's start it off with you. Beyond the introduction, please do confirm the individuals and communities that you serve, and tell us a little bit more, kind of from 5,000 feet, about the history of this agency.
No problem, John. And John, it's actually great to hear your voice, and I can't see you, but to hear your voice and be connected again. It's been many, many years since 2001.
Yes.
Yeah, I am currently the Chief Executive Officer of the Women and Family Center with an office in Meriden on Colony Street. The Women and Family Center began as the YWCA of Meriden back in 1889. We've been serving the Central Connecticut community since then, mainly in the areas of Meriden, Wallingford, Cheshire, and Middletown. with a lot of our services. And then we also, one of our main services, sexual assault crisis services, we provide services in all of Middlesex and New Haven County. So we have a much wider reach for that specific program. And with our reach program for homeless youth, we actually serve youth from across the state. They get referred over to us through the Coordinated Access Network, or CAN. So we have provide a very wide group of services for both Central Connecticut and probably reach out to larger areas of the state of Connecticut as well.
Well, earlier we focused quite a lot on domestic violence during Domestic Violence Awareness Month, but here we are in April, Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So not only does that mean that the Women and Family Center is continuing to kind of work up to the red line, at your maximum capacity to take care of the day-to-day and hour-to-hour needs of the folks in your community, but you also have the added responsibility of advocacy to create more awareness around sexual assault prevention and issues tied to that victimization. So let's start there. Please, Carissa, jump in as well, if appropriate. Give us the background on what folks in your area need to know if they are either the victim themselves or someone they care about is a victim of sexual assault. Is your agency the one they would either get referred to or call?
Yeah, so we provide, as I said, sexual assault awareness, sexual assault crisis services. We're a part of the Connecticut Alliance to End Sexual Violence, which is our state agency. The Connecticut Alliance has 9 member agencies across the state. We are the member agency that serves Middlesex and New Haven counties. We have a 24/7 hotline for people who are English speaking. They can dial 888-999-5545 to get to our hotline. And for people who are Spanish speaking, they can dial 888-568-8332 is our Spanish hotline. And then we also have a texting option as well, which I don't have that number off right here, but I'll get it to you before we close out here. They can call us 24/7, 7 days a week. We have people, advocates and volunteers who are on monitoring the lines, and they respond to any call. And also, if anybody who's experienced sexual violence that goes to an emergency room, all of the emergency rooms in the area know about the Women and Family Center, and they know to call us directly so that we can then respond with an advocate or volunteer to meet with the survivor at the hospital and help them to understand what their options are, understand what their what the process is that they can go through if they choose. And we just kind of help them and advocate for them so that they can get back to some level of empowerment after being in such a heinous situation as experienced sexual violence.
Yes, certainly no incident of sexual assault lacks its heinous element. Certainly sexual assault against children is particularly horrific, and you guys really come on strong, not only in terms of the resources that you can bring to bear to support entire families when children are victims, but also even offering tips to parents and friends of sexually assaulted children right there on your website. So if people may be questioning whether or not the right thing to do is call the Women and Family Center, they can actually go on there and get some idea of the kind of support you provide. The other thing I really like is the fact that your TLC doesn't just end when the judicial process or the initial intake of the victim or victims end. You have a sexual assault survivor support group as well.
Oh, absolutely. We have a number of support groups for various individuals who have experienced sexual violence, whether it be a parent of a child who has experienced, or sometimes it's an adult who was sexually assaulted as a child. Mm. And one of the things that happens with people who have experienced sexual violence, especially as children, is they repress the feelings and repress the memory, and then something happens, something at some point in their lives that we call triggering, where they may smell cigar smoke or smell a certain cologne or something like that, and all of a sudden everything comes screaming forward that they have repressed for so long, and suddenly they're in a situation where they need some counseling. So at that point, if they call our number, we can then talk to them and help them with the situation, and then also help to refer them to services that might be help them, such as other consultants or clinical care that would be able to help them. And then we also do one-on-one counseling and small group counseling for individuals, at our sites and at community sites as well.
Mm. That's great. There's another aspect of critical intervention that your Women and Family Center provides in the communities you serve to young people, and that is ensuring that when their school day ends, they don't just hit the street or go home alone, that they can actually come and participate in after-school programs that really provide a great deal of socialization and enrichment versus some of the lesser palatable alternatives, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Our STAR before and after school program, STAR standing for Science, Technology, Arts, and Recreation, provides services at Pulaski, Hale, and Hanover Elementary Schools here in Meriden, and we provide an educational before and after school program that helps them improve their abilities in science, technology, arts, and recreation. And we have on-site tutors to help them with their homework. We have, and it's something that's available to everybody, no matter what their socioeconomic status. We have state grants to help pay for that, and we also are connected to Care for Kids, which can also pay for a young person to join our after-school programs, before-school programs. So we have a very beneficial program and some great professionals that help these young people have a positive after-school program that's both nurturing and educational, so that we're not really an extension of the school day, but we kind of augment the school day so that we can then do some nice fun things and then help them get their homework done, so that when their moms and dads are done working, they go home and they can just be family and just maybe go watch TV or play board games or whatever. Mom or dad doesn't have to worry about getting the kids through homework as well, because we get that done for them.
That's awesome. Folks, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Wayne Velitis. Carissa Conway is also on the line with us. They are both representing the Women and Families Center, serving the greater Meriden area and communities around it, up to Cheshire, Middletown, down into Wallingford, with myriad services. We're going to come back and talk about their employment training programs, who those programs serve, and then really spend a few serious minutes talking about youth homelessness with Carissa and Project Reach, and inviting you to the Women and Family Center of Meriden's inaugural Walk for Hope to End Homelessness. That's coming up on May 7th. We'll give you all the details, and hopefully we'll see you out supporting that. So Wayne and Carissa, stick with us, and folks, we'll be back in just a moment. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Griffin Health's 20th annual Children's Health and Safety Fair is coming up Sunday, April 30th, rain or shine, from 11 to 3 at Warsaw Park in Ansonia, to help families get ready for a fun and healthy summer. Griffin Hospital's Community Outreach and Valley Parish Nurse Program, Safe Kids of Greater Nautic Valley, Griffin Faculty Physicians, and Area Health and Safety Organizations are converging to offer free healthy treats, raffles, games, and information on a variety of health, wellness, and safety issues. So get the kids together and come out, or visit griffinhealth.org for more information. Well, thanks for sticking with us. We're back with Wayne Velitis and Carissa Conway. They're representing the Women and Families Center, serving Greater Meriden and the communities of Wallingford, Middletown, and Cheshire with many services. We already heard about their after-school programs in Greater Meriden, as well as their sexual assault services here in April, since it is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Every month is an issue when it comes to homelessness, particularly youth homelessness, and that's where Project Reach comes in, and that is the entree for Carissa Conway, who is the Project Reach head for the agency. Carissa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you guys have a pretty robust program for addressing homelessness. Why don't you give us the kind of the Highline perspective on Project Reach as it exists at your agency?
Sure. So currently Project Reach serves young adults ages 18 to 24 that are experiencing literal homelessness or housing instability. And it starts with our youth navigator who completes CAN assessments. We have a coordinated entry system for homelessness. And so she, when speaking with youth, identifies, you know, what the barriers are that prevent them from remaining stably housed. She's looking at whether or not there are diversionary measures that can take place. Could we do some family mediation? Is it a one-time security deposit or a rental payment that could prevent someone from becoming homeless? And she really follows them through our system as it exists currently. So that if they fall off the radar, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like the Women and Family Center really has the preventative issues covered well in terms of, you know, trying to mitigate the step between at risk and actual homelessness.
Yes, our goal is to really try to prevent someone from entering into the homeless service system.
So if they do,
Yeah,
they transition to you. How do you folks provide them with a roof over their head and some support?
Yes. So a young person could enroll into our transitional housing program, and that program offers young adults a stable place to live for a period not to exceed 18 months, where we provide a menu of case management services and other supportive services around mental health or educational and career development, basic life skills, and access to other services in our communities.
So this
Kids
are required to.
Our kids are required to meet with a case manager at least once a week. I have a 24-hour staffing, and so they're required to sit and really meet with folks once a week to address any barriers that they might be presented with, but also to identify how they're how they're doing. They develop a case plan in order to get to a place where they can achieve a level of independence and self-sufficiency. And so, you know, we want to talk about what that looks like.
From your perspective, leading this program, can you recall a particular success story where you were either able to, kind of swoop in and help prevent a family or a young person from being homeless, or were able to get someone into your transition program and really see them find a permanent home for themselves and blossom?
Sure. So I think about a young lady who she was one of the first young ladies that enrolled in our program. And she stayed with us for a full 18 months. And while with us, she graduated high school. She worked for our before and after school program. She also attended a senior prom while with us and, you know, really worked towards saving money and getting a full-time job while with us as well. And so she, once she left our program, she got married and had a baby. And she had moved away for a little while with her partner. And then she moved back and actually began working for our program. And so in some ways, there was a level of like she was giving back to other young people in our community by coming back to work with us.
Yeah, beautiful story.
And now
full circle.
And now she has a two. Yeah, so she's full. Now she has a young son of her own who's a year and a half, and she's working full time at an area business and is doing very well.
That's fantastic. Good. You also mentioned, and we can talk for just a minute or so, about the employment services, whether it is for homeless individuals or individuals at risk for homelessness, sexual assault victims, or others in the community. It's called Open Door, and it provides training for high school students. There's an ESL program. In a minute or so, if you could just give us a quick orientation about
that. Sure, John. So our Open Door program provides employment training. We get funding through the Workforce Alliance and the State Department of Education to provide employment training to youth who have barriers to employment that wouldn't otherwise be able to go through trainings. We help them to go through CNA trainings and human services trainings and things like that. We also provide ESL classes like EL Civics, which provides civics education and general English language skills with the bend on helping them to improve their employability. We also provide family literacy for individuals who are immigrants to help them work with their children, teach them how they can help their children improve their English language skills as well, as they do little things like make cake together and things like that, that ways that they can, you know, help their own children to improve their skills. And then, you know, all of our programs, you know, quite honestly, we have people that are residents of our Robbins House and Wish House that did experience sexual violence, and we were able to have our advocates work with them. And then we also provide employment training to the youth who are staying in the Project Reach programs, and they can come down and go through employment training. So we really kind of look at the Women and Family Center as a bit of a wraparound service for all of our services being available to all the residents of our Wish and our Robbins Houses.
So if people are listening to the program or the podcast and they're getting inspired and thinking that there's a great agency, how can I help support it, then they can be part of the first ever Walk for Hope to End Homelessness coming up on May 7th. We've got about 2 minutes. If you can just let folks know where they could go to learn more, to register, and where's the event happening?
So, yeah, no problem. The Walk for Hope is our inaugural run. We're very fortunate to have Ulbrich Stainless Steel as our title sponsor for the event. We're very happy to have them to come in and be our title sponsor. The Walk for Hope will be happening on the Choate Rosemary Hall campus. It'll be a two-mile, relative, pretty flat walk across that campus. And then there, you know, through the walk, we'll have some people playing music. And then afterwards, we're going to have a big picnic with a band playing back at by their athletic center. And it's going to be a fun day for people to come on out, walk a little bit, and, you know, help us raise money to keep our Robbins House open. I do want to share that our Robbins House program lost its funding in September of this year when the Administration for Children and Family, what happened, there was about 150 programs across the country that were all in their last year of funding, and they only had funding for about 80 programs for the coming year. So we ended up not getting funded, but we decided we were going to keep Robbins House open for another year, and we've reached out to various foundations and individuals and done a lot of fundraising, and we intend to keep it open and reapply for the funding to start again in October of next year. So we're very confident we'll get it this time. So the funds will actually keep our Robbins House residents in their residence until the end of September. So this is a very important fundraiser for us, and we really just can't ask the public enough to, you know, anything you can do would be more than helpful. You can go to our website at www.womenfamilies.org, or you can go to www.jbsports.com, and you can there and then see information about the Walk for Hope.
Wayne Valaitis, CEO, and Carissa Conway, Project Reach Coordinator for the Women and Family Center, serving Greater Meriden, Cheshire, Middletown, and Wallingford. We hope folks will come out to this inaugural event on May 7th or find some way to support this organization, particularly in terms of the Robin House, which is currently facing some issues in regards to funding, and they'd like to keep that open. WomenFamilies.org is the website. Thank you both for being part of the program today. All right. Well, as you heard in the introduction, we're going to head north and east into the country and visit via the magic of radio, the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp, which was founded back in 1988 by Paul Newman to give every child, no matter what the kind of illness they may have, a chance to raise a little hell. And appropriately, this camp has provided that opportunity and a different kind of healing to seriously ill children and their families, free of charge. They're a community that celebrates the spirit of childhood, the sound of laughter, the feeling of endless possibility, and certainly now I think our guest Hillary Axmeyer is with us. She is the chief program manager for the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp. And Hillary, I'm sure you could attest that we could add a resurrection to that tagline, because you guys through the entire period since the camp was founded by Paul Newman back in the late 80s has had a great run, but fairly recently you suffered quite a tragedy, right?
We did. Yeah, absolutely, John. Thank you so much for having me on today. I'm always excited about the opportunity to talk about the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp. As you mentioned, on February 12th, 2021, right in the middle of COVID, when, you know, we thought things couldn't get much more challenging, they did. We experienced a significant fire, really tragic fire, in our arts and crafts and woodshop building, which were connected. They also held some other spaces, including our camp store, our cooking zone, another sort of lounge area, and we lost all the buildings within just a couple hours. However, the story does not end there, which I'm really proud of, and it's really just that, you know, a huge testament to our community. With the response, not only by our local firefighters who came quickly and responded, our Ashford firefighters, as well as our neighboring towns and the University of Connecticut.
Yeah, quite a turnout.
Oh, it was unbelievable. Yeah. It was just incredible. And they really, they knew immediately that those buildings were going to be a loss, but they really focused on saving the other buildings on site. So that was incredible. And then within, and I'm sure you've heard us say this, yes, already, but within about a week of that fire, the response from our community was, every time I talk about it, I get goosebumps. In fact, it was just incredible. We had over 4,000 donors respond, and we raised more than $4.5 million to be able to build back what we lost, but even more so and even better, build back better and stronger. And smarter. And so we just had that ribbon cutting a couple of weeks ago, and we have a wonderful, new, inclusive, accessible building that we're just, we're just totally thrilled about.
Certainly, since the late 80s, a lot has happened in regards to the ADA and accessibility
necessities. So I'm sure the ability to, even in the worst possible scenario, wipe a portion of the slate clean and start over has really not just put you where you need to be today, but puts you where you're going to need to be for the next 20, 30, 50 years at the camp, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And well said. And that's, I think, one of the, you know, sort of the silver linings of this situation was that, you know, camp, as you said, was built, it was built pre-ADA. You know, we were built in 1987, 1988. And so although the camp was brilliantly designed, there were, you know, we know a lot more now than we did then. And
that was back in the days when you had to plug your power tools in.
Sure. Right? Absolutely. A lot has changed. And so I actually say that often that, you know, we're always making renovations and changes, but what, you know, the fire unfortunately did is it created a whole blank template for us to really not only work with what we, you know, had, but really to think about this with a really fresh perspective and say, how can we meet the future and the varied needs of our families and those that we want to serve. And so thinking about participant autonomy and ensuring that everyone uses the building the same way. The day of some people being able to go in through the ramp and other, you know, people going in through the stairs, we want everyone to be able to use the space the same way. And so everyone accesses the space the same way. There is no, as we always say with our design team, there's no cheats. If you're able-bodied, you walk in one way. If you're in a wheelchair, you walk in the same way. And that really was our main objective when designing this space that we're And also thinking about the environment. We have geothermal to heat and cool our space, which is the first building that we have on site that has utilized, a geothermal system. So I could go on and on about excited we are about this new building, but I can't, you know, it's really just because of the incredible response from our community, in particular Newman's Own and the Travelers and Travelers Championship, which responded within 48 hours of the fire.
Yeah, as you said, $4 million raised in variably the blink of an eye. But suffice it to say, perhaps the COVID era was another blessing in disguise, because no matter how fast you raised the money, the level of devastation from the fire at the Hole in the Wall Gang camp undoubtedly would have prevented a full and robust camp experience for the summer of 21, and it provided the necessary time to line up the ducks and get everything not just right, but as I said earlier, perfect, and positions the Hole in the Wall Gang camp for two or three future generations or more of campers. That's great news, folks. If you're just joining us, we're chatting with Hillary Axtmeyer. She is the Chief Program Manager at the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp, which is, as you may know, dedicated to providing a different kind of healing to seriously ill children and their families free of charge. So, Hillary, switching gears, at this point now with the camp, undoubtedly soliciting and getting campers ready for the 2023 summer season, how are some of the ways, our listeners might be able to become involved either as volunteers or in terms of support or just awareness? What are a few of the most important things that folks need to know today about the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp?
Great. Yeah, absolutely. So I think what I always like to start with when I get asked that question is, I think most people, they've heard about us, they know a little bit about us, they know that we, and I think most people think we're a camp in Ashford, Connecticut for children with serious illnesses. We offer this amazing summer camp program. That is true. But we do so much more. And I really want to make sure that folks are aware of that. So we started Paul Newman, brilliantly thought this up and wanted to have a place, as you mentioned, where kids could come and raise a little hell and enjoy a summer camp experience. What we learned from that first summer in 1988 was that what we're doing is really powerful, and it goes beyond those gates. And so we offer year-round services on-site in Ashford, Connecticut, but also directly to our communities through our family outreach program and through our hospital outreach program, where we go directly into hospitals. We have a staff of more than 30 hospital outreach specialists. We're currently in almost 40 hospitals throughout the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, where we bring that spirit of camp, that healing power of camp directly to kids who are hospitalized, whether that be bedside or in clinics. And so that's one of the biggest things that we're doing year round are those outreach programs. And then our family weekends on site. So we serve the whole family. We serve siblings during our summer program. And also our family weekends happen year round. We take a little break in January and February when it's cold, but our family weekends are happening throughout the year, where we have the amazing opportunity to serve the entire family. And so they can come together and experience that magic of camp. And I'll just say briefly, we're growing, we're evolving. We're so excited. We recently announced plans to open a second location in Queenstown, Maryland. And that is happening. We have this beautiful new site that we are starting renovations and construction in the next few months, with plans to open up a whole nother location in Maryland in 2024.
So for folks who are listening, who may want to get involved, let's start with those who are the stars of the camp, the attendees.
Yes.
How do people get to go to the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I should say it's really important. It is completely free for all of our participants to participate in any of our programs. So it is, we are completely funded through really our incredibly generous community of donors and corporations and events. So it is free for all of our participants. So we really find there's two ways to get involved. We serve children with serious illnesses, as you know, and a number of different diagnoses would make a child eligible to participate. And so that information can all be found on our website. And so I encourage you to go to our website, which is www.holeinthewallgang.org. And you'll have a chance to learn more about those primary diagnoses, which is essentially our oncology, immunology, hematology, metabolic diseases, as well as some other rare diseases. So if those categories, fit into what you're experiencing, then definitely, we'd be a fit. But I do encourage you, if you have any questions, to reach out to us directly. And so individuals, families can apply directly through our website or give us a call. We also recruit directly from hospitals. And so you can reach out to a social worker, your provider, whether that's your physician, a nurse practitioner, social worker, child life specialist at your hospital, and they'll be able to give you some information about how to participate in our programs.
Okay. And in the last minute or so that we have with you, Hillary, certainly folks can go directly to holeinthewallgang.org and hit the donate button and make a donation toward the cause.
Absolutely.
But for folks who are really passionate about wanting to help, but are unable to make a cash donation, are there volunteer opportunities?
Oh, absolutely. And John, and it is so important. We depend on our volunteers. It is a huge part of our program. It is a huge part of our community. We rely on those volunteers. So in a traditional pre-COVID year, we would have as many as 4,000 volunteers involved in all aspects of our programming, whether that be directly working with the kids or helping at development events. And so we are always looking for volunteers. We still need them for this summer, for weekends. So if you are interested, you can also go onto that website and click on the volunteer programs, and then you will be directed to all the right people to get all the answers that you may need to be involved. But it is I can't say enough about our volunteers and the impact they make for all of our programs.
Well, rising from the ashes of a tragic fire, the Hole in the Wall Gang camp lives on in a brand new and exciting way, with the prospect of a sister camp in Maryland on the boards right now. The Hole in the Wall Gang camp, founded in 1988 by Paul Newman, with an effort to give every child, no matter what their illness, the chance to, as he put it, raise a little hell, through a variety of year-round programs, as you heard, offered on-site in hospitals and clinics and right in campers' homes and communities. The thousands of volunteers and hundreds of staff and supporters of the Hole in the Wall Gang camp serve more than 20,000 seriously ill children and family members every year. Hillary Axmeyer is the organization's chief program manager. Hillary, great to meet you and great to hear about all the resurrection and fantastic things that are to be in store for those getting involved with the Hole in the Wall Gang camp in 2023 and for many years and decades beyond. Thanks so much for your time today.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.